You take the high road?
It's a lovely one. It takes you through the fields, through the sheep, up the rabbit tracks to this lovely temple, and the views are superb.
Or you can take the low road.
You don't need to climb to the top of the mountains. There are beautiful woodland forest walks.
To enjoy the bonnie trails of Scotland. Coming up, a pair of Scottish guides recommend their favourite places to hike or ramble on an abundance of marked walking trails in Scotland. The waterfront renovations along the harbour in Oslo have turned it into a civic gathering place. You can relax or get your steps in year-round.
We're not afraid in the winter to walk around. We're not afraid in the rain to walk around. We're not afraid in the summer heat.
We'll hear about the uniquely Norwegian ways to enjoy some time by the water. And listeners share what they've been doing to beat the crowds we're finding at many of Europe's top tourist sites. Let's travel together for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. We've set our sights on a couple of cool destinations in the north of Europe today on Travel with Rick Steves. In a bit, an American who married a local and is raising his family in Oslo recommends options for getting some fresh air and enjoying the views in the Norwegian capital. And later in the hour, listeners share their strategies for coping with the crowds they're finding at many of Europe's top attractions. Let's start out today looking at the range of hiking adventures you can have on the Bonnie Bonnie Trails across Scotland. Scotland is a hiker's paradise, just as long as you bring some rain gear. You might not think it has the climate for it, but enjoying the great outdoors is almost as Scottish as wearing a kilt and tossing a caber. And when your outdoors are as bonny as Scotland's, enjoying a walk or a hike just makes perfect sense. To talk about their favorite wee strolls in Scotland, I'm joined by two Scottish guides and the co-hosts of the Scottish Blethers podcast, Helen Houston and Liz Lister. Helen and Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth.
You know, I've got this screensaver that keeps popping up on my TV featuring the most pristine nature imaginable. And when I look up where that's from, it's often the north of Scotland, Orkney or Skye. Absolute glorious nature, often mixed with the sea. And I think there must be some unforgettable hikes in Scotland. I'd like to hear from both of you. Helen, when you want to take a walk, what's one or two great hikes that you like?
Well, one of my favorite ones is one I can do straight from the house, which is to go up to what we call the temple. And the temple is a round tower that was built by a retired sea captain. One story is he built it up on the hill above his house so he could escape from his wife from time to time. And the other story is that he could look out over the Firth of Forth and watch his ships sailing in. But it's a lovely one. It takes you through the fields, through the sheep, and up the rabbit tracks, to this lovely temple, and the views are superb. And then walk down past the golf course, and then just another few yards, and you're back home for a cup of tea.
You know, that's from your town, which is, what town would that be in, actually?
Well, this is a village called Sallin, just outside Dunfermline.
Okay, Sallin, S-A-L-I-N-E. And, you know, when I was hearing you describe that, that could be any number of places. You've got
Absolutely.
A folly. You've got a view, you've got a golf course, you've got a nice circular walk, and you're back at your B&B, and you've had a lovely time out. Liz, tell me about some mountain hike or some coastal path that you enjoy.
Right, well, keeping it local, keeping it in Fife, we have a coastal path in Fife, which stretches all the way from down in the south in Kincardine up to Tayport outside Dundee, and it's cut into different sections. And for us, it's easy to go out. We went on Sunday. You can walk along. It was a bit muddy on Sunday, wet weather, but you can walk along the coast. You have things like salt pans, castles, lovely scenery to enjoy. And then instead of the cup of tea, at the end of it, there's a little chocolate shop in Pittenweem, which is a great destination.
Nice to have a destination for your walk, and in Scotland there's plenty of those. Now, Scotland has mountains, but most of them are, they wouldn't be thought of as mountains in Switzerland, but they really feel big when you're right there. Tell us about what we call the Munros, Helen.
Yes, the Munros is any mountain over 3,000 feet, and they were catalogued by a man called Munro, believe it or not. It's now become a bit of a sport. People go Munro bagging, which means that you try to climb all 282 of the Munros in Scotland. Huh. There are, I think, 284 Munros in total, all of which but two are in Scotland. So it is a Munro bagging thing. I've done a few Munros myself. I've done Ben Nevis and Ben McDewey and Ben Lomond and some of the other ones a few years ago, Rick.
Nevis is the highest mountain, isn't it?
I know, I've been there, yeah. Yes. But they are beautiful walks, beautiful walk. The thing about Scottish mountains is that they look easy, they look low, but they're quite complex and quite dangerous at times.
Elizabeth Lister and Helen Houston are with us on Travel with Rick Steves. They're tour guides based in the historic Kingdom of Fife. It's just a wee hop over the Firth from Edinburgh. They've earned the Blue Badge qualification from the Scottish Tourist Guides Association. Liz and Helen share their knowledge and love for their native Scotland in the podcast conversations they record over a cup of tea. It's called Scottish Blethers. They're also on Facebook at Scottish Blethers, spelled B-L-E-T-H-E-R-S. Now, Liz, when you think of bagging a Munro, I love picking up all these terms when I'm talking to my Scottish friends. When you think of bagging a Munro, climbing to the top of a peak, you get that king of the mountain feeling. And I just love that. It's so rewarding. What is one of your favorite king of the mountain feelings that you've earned on a walk?
Well, I would first of all correct you. The only bagging I do is my shopping, or as we would say in Scotland, our messages in Tesco. That's the only bagging. You'll not get me at the top of mountains anymore. But what I love is the low-level walks. So, you know, if you're up in an area, we are blessed by having two national parks in Scotland, and one of them is the Cairngorms, which has one of the most significant proportions of your Munros. And you don't need to climb to the top of the mountains. There are beautiful woodland forest walks. Very often your destination will be a loch. One of my favourites is the Green Loch, which is said to be green because the fairies washed their clothes in it. And it's a lovely walk, easily accessible from Aviemore, which is at the centre of the Cairngorm National Park.
Cairngorm is a national park. Are there a lot of national parks? National parks are a great part of America's nature.
There are only two in Scotland. There may be more in the future, but it was the areas which were coming under greatest pressure from tourists. So it was recognised that you had to maintain that. Very often they have a lot of our endangered species, so you have to look after the natural environment, but at the same time they are living places, and so you have to make sure that people who live there have employment. So the Cairngorm National Park, as Loch Lomond National Park before it, was set up to manage this balance.
I understand it's designated a net zero park. What does that mean?
It means that we'll never get to a situation where we're not producing carbon dioxide. But what we want to get to is a situation where we are soaking up as much carbon dioxide as we're putting out. And the way that the Scottish government intends to get to net zero is by planting millions of trees. And so we have in the Cairngorms and in the Highlands in general, rewilding. And the areas are going back to natural tree cover.
Ah, okay. Hey, Helen, I'm inspired by England's insistence that people have a basic right to walk across the field. If any landowner puts up a fence, they need to provide a gate. And I understand every once in a while the Ramblers Association has what they call a mass trespass, where everybody gets out and crosses all those fields and just asserts their right as walkers to be able to walk where they want to go. Does Scotland have anything like that sort of spirit of the right to walk?
Well, we actually have the right to roam in Scotland. There is no law of trespass in Scotland. So we have the right to roam wherever we want to. Any landowner only has the right to fence off a reasonable part of his ground to give him privacy around his dwelling house. But we have wonderful pathways and waymarkers all over Scotland. And the right to roam means you leave nothing except a footprint. That you don't leave anything, you can go wherever you like, and so long as you treat the countryside with respect.
Yeah. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're taking a wee saunter now through the best walks in Scotland with our guides, Liz Lister and Helen Houston. They've been guiding in Scotland now for decades, and they are the co-hosts of the Scottish Blethers podcast. Blether means chat. It's spelled B-L-E-T-H-E-R. In Scottish Blethers is the time that Helen and Liz get together and talk about their culture. And Liz, what sort of information services, ranger stations, loos, pubs, bus stops and shelters and so on do you encounter? How civilized is the walk, or is it just totally in the wilds?
It depends very much on which walk you're doing. There's been a huge growth in recent years in waymarked walks with a theme, whether it's long distance routes or whether it's pilgrimages or whether it's historical like Mary Queen of Scots trails. And those, as Helen said, are all well waymarked and they tend to have good facilities along the routes. But for many people, they want to get away from that and just get into the great outdoors.
I know you're a fan of Robbie Burns, the great poet. And I also know that the Romantic era brought us great poetry and also an appreciation of nature. Is there any Robbie Burns poem that brings to mind a hike?
Well, I wouldn't step on Helen's toes for this one. She's the lady for this. I mean, the obvious one that comes to mind is the wee mouse. So I'll hand over, I'll defer to my colleague for this one.
Helen.
Yeah, well, I think the famous one for Robert Burns is the mouse. Wee sleekit coor and timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie, that thou should start a wassie hasty wi' bicker and brattle. I would be laith to rin and chase thee wi' murder and pattle. Robert Burns was a farmer.
Did you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, the translation of that for Helen is he was a farmer and he was out threshing the corn. And as he was cutting it down with the scythe, he ruined the home of a little field mouse. And so this was him reflecting on the bigger picture of mankind and how so easily things can aft gang agley. They can all go wrong and you're left with no house and he's left with a guilty conscience.
Liz and Helen, I just love this idea of mixing a hike with a pub. And I've got these experiences that I remember where I've just had a brilliant hike and I finally reach the pub of my dreams and I step inside and my glasses fog up and I pet a dog and I join the scene. Can you relate to that, Liz, when you take a walk and you step into a pub?
Absolutely. As you say, there's always got to be some destination. It might be a cup of tea, but always preferable. One of the famous pubs in Scotland is the Clachegan, which is in Glencoe, which is a very popular area for walking. So people go there to, and Isle of Skye, you've got so many different famous pubs up there as well. So yeah, it's very much a part of a hike.
And Helen, when you step into a pub, what's a moment of joy that you have in a pub after a hike?
Well, I think if you step into some of the pubs, as Liz has described, but sometimes you'll find there's music there. There's an accordion player or a violinist, a fiddler or something like that. You're just playing away quietly in the corner and everybody's just enjoying that kind of peaceful moment as their cheeks are rosy red and they're getting themselves warm, etc. And that lovely music is just filling the air. That's lovely. I like that.
It just complements a walk beautifully, doesn't it? This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with our guides, Helen Houston and Liz Lister. You've just made me want to go to Scotland and mix nature and the culture and the beautiful people together. Thank
and
you
the
both
whiskey.
Very much. And the whiskey. Thank you very much for joining us and best wishes with your Scottish blethers.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
Helen Houston and Liz Lister share advice for walking around Edinburgh in an earlier visit with us. You can listen to that and find links to their websites in the notes that we post for this week's show. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. Recommendations for getting outdoors in the Norwegian capital. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. Oslo, the capital of Norway, is one of the fastest changing and I would say most improved cities in Europe. Its sprawling harborfront, until recently a fjordside industrial wasteland, is totally revisioned and it's become a vibrant, people-friendly residential neighborhood and a delight for visitors as well. Curtis Rojak is an American who's adopted Oslo as his hometown. He left America 25 years ago and he's settled into Norway and now he runs a bike tour company there. I had such fun biking around town with Curtis as I updated my Scandinavia guidebook on my last visit. I thought I've got to get Curtis on Travel with Rick Steves to share his enthusiasm for his adopted hometown. So now Curtis joins us to get us up to date on this thriving Scandinavian capital. Curtis, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Good to see you again.
Yeah, you know, for me, my family comes from Norway, and to visit with you in Oslo and that you went the other direction 25 years ago. Before we get into Oslo, tell us just about your story. How did you end up in Oslo?
I think like a lot of Americans,
had a travel bug that I wanted to itch in Europe. And so I first came to Europe in high school and was definitely bitten by the travel bug. And soon after that, I was here. That was in 1998, and I haven't looked back. Been living in Europe for the most part since 1998. Travels have taken me to a lot of countries, and along the way, I met a Norwegian girl, and that is now my wife, and we've got three kids. And so I am what we often refer to here in Norway as a love refugee.
I can understand. A love refugee in Norway. And how old are your kids?
They're 5, 8, and 10. So it keeps me busy.
So just in general, what were the big adjustments for you when you raising a family in Norway? How is that for an American? Is it an adjustment?
The biggest adjustment is a positive one. It is just such a family-focused society where the employers make sure that people are out the door at 3:30 in the summer, 4:30 in the winter. They kind of push you out to go home with your family. The kids have what I would consider pretty stress-free days at school with no grades until you're done with middle school. There are a lot of facets that are about making day-to-day life with kids, both for the kids and the parents, relatively stress-free compared to, I think, what a lot of other countries deal with. So that was a real positive adjustment, is just to kind of slow down, take it a bit easier, expect more time with the family.
Americans also have an image of Scandinavians as kind of miserable socialists, paying high taxes and having no choice and all this kind of thing. You've lived both lives. Norwegians clearly choose their style of government. In a nutshell, how is that working?
I think they chose in the past. And now, just like anywhere, the system is embedded in your daily life. So people almost don't think about it. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we take for granted here, given, is that you pay your taxes and in return, you get equivalent services. Mm-hmm. Now, so you get the really affordable daycares. You know, we're talking 1/7, 1/8 the price of the U.S. And it's universal. Every child has access as guaranteed daycare. Yeah. You get the paid maternity and paternity leave, which is 1 year at full salary. You have all of these benefits that come out of you paying the taxes. So you don't think too much about it. It's just it's become the norm, let's say, and maybe we have to thank previous generations for having created such a good social system that now, taking it for granted, I'm not sure if that's the right way. That has a very negative connotation, but you don't think about it. It's just that's the way things work, and they work well.
By the way, I'm talking with Curtis Rojak, and he leads bike tours in Oslo for his cleverly named company, Biking Biking. Curtis is joining us today to get us up to date on the rapidly changing cityscape of Norway's capital city, Oslo. And you can learn more about Curtis's work at his website, vikingbikingoslo.com. Curtis, you took me biking all along Oslo's harborfront. Describe the change in the harborfront of Oslo in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I can remember the first time I was on that harborfront, and it was 21 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was winter. It was bleak. There were very few people milling about. There was one stretch, which is known as Akerbrygga, which had been redeveloped, and the rest of the harbor was bleak and industrial, and no one dared to go there, and there was lots of cars and traffic and a container port. So that was my introduction to Oslo. And I get such a great pride out of seeing people's reactions now when they come on our tours to see Oslo through their eyes for the first time, mm-hmm. and realize just how much the city has grown and how much better it's gotten. It's like seeing Christmas through your children's eyes in a way. You get to see people lighting up going, oh, this opera house is amazing. This car-free downtown is amazing. You have all of this wonderful feedback. And I do think back often to that first impression I had more than two decades ago and how much it has improved. And it fills not just me with pride, but I will say the people of Oslo, we really do feel it here. There is a great pride in that part of the city.
Didn't they drill tunnels under the city? So if you're going from east to west, you don't even show your face in the city. You go under it. And if you go into the town, you got to pay an extra fee.
Yeah, there's tunnels everywhere. It's not just Oslo. I should say that Norway is the land of tunnels, two of the three longest road mm-hmm. tunnels in the world. We have roundabouts in our tunnels. We have rest areas in some of our tunnels that are so long around Norway. So Oslo, I think, took inspiration from this amazing network of tunnels that we've been building for the past 100 years and said, hey, if we can drill tunnels through mountains in the countryside, why couldn't we just do the same thing in the city? And so in the 1980s and 90s, they began the tunnel experiment. And it worked so great that now, you know, we're like gophers. We just keep digging and digging
gophers.
And digging in the tunnels. Yeah, the tunnel network just keeps expanding.
You know, when we were biking through what was this industrial wasteland, Now it is clearly a residential area. It's people-friendly. And there must have been a vision here. And you did a great job of describing it as we rolled through. But I'm thinking many American cities are sort of, they're becoming scary at night when there's nobody working there. And it's kind of desolate. It feels dangerous. But you don't have that feeling in Oslo because I think they value having that vibrancy that comes with people living upstairs above the business ground floor.
Absolutely. And making it so that the people who live there, if they want to get around, they don't jump in their car. You want to have boots on the ground. You need people biking. You need people walking. Even in the winter, it's not like Montreal or Minneapolis where they put the people underground or in tunnels. The cars are there. So the people are above ground. And, you know, we've got the Viking blood here. We're not afraid in the winter to walk around. We're not afraid in the rain to walk around. We're not afraid in the summer heat. You just see people at all times of day and all types of the year and all types of weather enjoying that harborfront promenade.
What did we find? Just paint the picture here, Curtis, because I remember just past the Munch Museum, we went inland a couple blocks and it was all new. It was all condos. It was all yacht club kind of restaurants on the ground floor. There was little parking lots for your kayak. There were floating saunas. Yes. There were playgrounds. I mean, paint a picture as if you're a realtor trying to sell me a condo. What do you have here?
I think what sums up the Oslo Harborfront more than anything is these floating saunas. It's the connection to using the water year-round. It started with just a group of ice bathers 20 years ago or so who were swimming from what was a container port. You know how industrial it was. And as the port got cleaned up, they went from ice bathers to building their first floating sauna to building a sauna village to now there are multiple sauna villages. Some of the saunas have motors on them and you can rent them and boat around in the inner harbor on a sauna, if you can imagine that. And the high season is actually fall, winter, and spring when the water is cold. Shows you the real Viking roots, and that also shows you how lively it is year-round. And that these saunas are used 12 months a year. The water has been cleaned up so everyone can swim. And it's become like a social meeting point. It's one of those few places in Oslo where you can just randomly talk to a stranger.
Yes, I felt that. It was a little community. It was sort of a vacation zone for locals, just for R&R.
Exactly. And community not in the exclusive way, like you have to be part of it and that will talk to you. No, community in that it's like embracing of anyone who wants to give it a shot. If you're a tourist and you're there, whether it is freezing cold in December or warm and sunny in the summer, just grab your swim trunks. You can just walk up. It's very affordable, too. I think most of these are about like $20 or something for a few hours. And
so you book your time, or you can just show up if there is a place. But you've got sunbathing areas. You've got ladder that goes into the water. You can jump into the fjord. Of course, you got your saunas. You got a little drink bar. And you got a warm welcome.
Absolutely. And you really feel like a local. It's a way in to kind of get a picture of what Norwegians value and the people who live in those areas value, which is this, even though you're in the heart of the downtown, you have that connection to nature. And that harbor promenade has completely given the fjord back to the people. And we have that contact with the water once again. That was gone for decades.
You didn't have the contact with the water before. You turned your back on the water almost. And now you've got the opera house facing the water. You've got the incredible Deichman Public Library facing the water. You've got the new National Museum right there. Let's talk about that bike tour that you and I went on together, Curtis. What was striking to me is there were old 1960s era industrial containers that were turned into information posts. There must have been 12 or 14 of these along a many mile long promenade for walking or for biking. Each one had a photograph of what it was like in the 60s and then what it's like today, and kind of gave you a little guided tour. And there's maps, and you bike from these info post to info post right by all this new development and this new vibrancy in Oslo.
Yeah, it's only about 5 years old, or so, let's say. They're calling it the Fjord City, or a Fjord Bien. And this was a way to try to get people in contact with the entire promenade, not to think, oh, it's just this row of restaurants. Actually, there's a wonderful redevelopment going on from one end to the other. And as you said, you can cover 13 or 14 of these containers. They're fun, too. The history is, you know, not just your standard, the king was here at this date. They have cartoon drawings. They show you maybe what it was like fishing in the 1800s. They show you the traffic in the 1960s. And they also will tell you what's coming next. So it gives you a little window into what's next.
Curtis Rojek's our guest from Oslo, Norway, right now on Travel with Rick Steves, with recommendations for enjoying the freshly renovated harborfront amenities of the Norwegian capital. Curtis is a dual national of Norway and the U.S. and runs a bike rental and walking tour company called Viking Biking. Their website is vikingbikingoslo.com and includes blog posts and photos from Curtis and his team. Okay, Curtis, I'd like to redo a little bit of that biking tour that I enjoyed so much with you. And we'll just pretend we're doing this together. We're biking around the underneath the medieval fortress, and I see a statue of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in Norway.
Yeah, pretty surprising, especially for American tourists. But the U.S., of course, during World War II, played an active role in supporting Norway. And so the Queen and the kids of the royal family actually were sponsored to go over to the United States as refugees. And so we've put that statue up as a thanks and a memorial to the U.S. who provided help.
And then we come to an old warehouse, and it's been turned into a food court called Vipa. And we went there for a wonderful lunch. What's inside?
Yeah, so on the outside, you see it, and it looks like just an old warehouse covered in street art, and you might be a bit skeptical. But actually, inside is one of the coolest vibes of Oslo, full of different vendors, whether you want Polish pierogies, fresh sushi, typical Norwegian food, great drinks that are just Scandinavian for the most part, and one of the best views of the fjord, with always sun on the wall, it feels like.
And it was more tasty than ever for me because of the strength of the dollar. What is there, 11 crowns in a dollar now? It's half the price I expect it to be. I mean, Oslo used to be brutally expensive, and now I think it's no more expensive than France or Germany.
Absolutely. We feel it when we're traveling out of Norway. All of a sudden, the U.S. feels like an expensive destination to us. So for Americans coming here, yeah, you can eat and drink and not worry about it too much.
Okay, we round the corner and we come to a funky little fishmonger's shack where they're evangelical about giving you tastes of fish fresh off the boat.
Yeah. They are a family-run business that's been going for generations and is just a kind of a pursuit of passion. And it's not just fish. They also will sell you your reindeer, your elk, all of the unusual wild game meats that we still really do eat here, especially at nice festivities like a Christmas or a wedding.
I felt guilty. He was just stuffing me with smoked salmon and shrimp. It's a good way of doing business, man. I went back the next day. Then we come to this amazing opera house, which is, it's like a landmark piece of architecture.
Yeah, when it opened in 2008, done by a local Oslo architecture firm, it did win best new building in the world. So yeah, it's not just you and I who think it's a beautiful thing. It is the pride of modern Oslo.
I parked the bike, you hung outside, and I went inside and I took a little tour and was very impressed by the interior architecture. And also, it's a sloping public piazza on the rooftop, and you can have events on the rooftop as well.
Yeah, we actually, in the summer, there's a lot of concert series where the stage and the artists are floating on a stage in the fjord, and all of the people watching are sitting on the opera using it as like a grandstand.
And then we come to kind of like a Norwegian Woodstock. It's a concert venue, a sauna venue. What's the nickname? A nomadic art project. Salt,
yes,
art
salt.
And music.
Inspired by northern Norway. So it has that traditional architecture of where they would dry the cod. That's why it's the A-frames that you would dry the cod on in northern Norway. And they've turned it into one of the largest public saunas in Europe, as well as they have debates inside the saunas. They have concerts in the saunas. They have food trucks around. It is one of the most emblematic places along the Oslo Harbor.
And we're doing this whole tour taking advantage of a bike loaner program in Oslo. And you walked me through this. And I'm pretty technophobic when it comes to a lot of these ways to pop in your credit card and get access to something around town like you're a local. But this works easy for a tourist. It costs $10, 100 crowns for 3 days. And then as long as we parked our bike and took another one every hour, it was free. It's designed for short little hops, right? But we could do this whole trip for one of these free loaner bikes.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are stations everywhere. Once you open the app, you can see a station, you know, just every couple hundred of yards, 100 meters. So it's really easy to find a place to pick up a bike or a place to return it. And so if you're going past like a Salt, for example, and you want to stop and eat something there and check out the sauna, there is one of these city bike share parkings right there.
And then the finale for me was coming back to the center, and there's a new bench in front of the Nobel Peace Prize Center. Of course, the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded in Oslo. The bench is shaped like a smile, and there's a quote from Nelson Mandela in front of it. Tell us about that peace bench.
I think you should know also that that whole area was probably the most industrial area of Oslo. And so that building where the Nobel Peace Prize Center is the old train station. And so for that to turn into a meeting point to talk about peace is almost emblematic. Like, we took an area that no one wanted to go to and turned it into a meeting point of peace. And so they just put this bench in front of there, and it's supposed to bring people together. You know, people sit on it. You see people always taking pictures, and it does exactly that. It really does invite conversation, people to be together before they've gone in to see the exhibit or after they've come out, kind of to be inspired by where they are, but also just a way for humanity, all these different nations visiting Oslo, to come together in the spirit of the Nobel Peace Prize.
You cannot sit on that bench without coming together because, as I mentioned, it's shaped like a
smile. It's curved.
You have to sit together. And I love that quote from Mandela. If I can remember correctly, it's the most powerful weapon is talking with each other.
And that's you have what that to bench talk is. With each other. It's an invitation to chatting.
And it just feels like the whole waterfront is the same way.
Yeah, that is right next to the stop number 6 on that harborfront promenade that we were talking about, if people are interested in it. So there you go.
So there you go. Hey, Curtis Rojak, thank you so much for joining us. Best wishes as you lead people around Oslo on your bike tours. And I hope to see you on two wheels next time I'm back in Oslo.
Thank you very much, Rick.
We keep hearing reports of how crowded all the famous tourist sites are these days as people make up for lost travel time over the last few years. We'll hear what listeners have to report about how they deal with that next on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-7425. And by email, it's radio@ricksteves.com. If you've been getting out and traveling lately, you've probably found a lot of places are attracting quite a few visitors. It feels like we're all still eager to take those trips we could only dream about during the height of the pandemic. So we've asked some of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners to tell us how they've been coping with the crowds on their own adventures across Europe. How have the crowds forced you to adjust your travel itineraries? Our phone number is 877-333-7425. Mary's on the phone right now from Wilder in Kentucky with some reports on crowds and her travels. Mary, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I was in London this past April, and it was Easter break, so it was a very crowded city. And for people who didn't have tickets in advance, I noticed they certainly weren't getting into the attractions that they'd wanted to see. I, however, had a plan in advance to see less crowded places, and I'm really glad I did that because whereas I did go into Westminster Abbey, I was elbow to elbow with people, but I also went to Suffolk Cathedral, and it was just as beautiful, very enjoyable, and there were only a handful of people there. A similar situation when I went to the National Gallery, again, elbow to elbow. There were about 500 people waiting in line who didn't have tickets. Fortunately, I had tickets in advance, and I went in a separate entrance, but I really couldn't see everything I wanted to see. So, lucky for me, I had a backup plan to go to the Courtauld Gallery at lovely Somerset House, so I did that one afternoon. And again, you know, there were a few dozen people there, and I got very close to some absolutely beautiful paintings. They have a fine collection, and Somerset House is just gorgeous. So it was just a really nice way to enjoy London and go to the lesser crowded places and have the same experience that you would have going to the big places.
You know, Mary, it's so interesting you say that because just 2 weeks ago, I was in London. I was at Suffolk Cathedral and I was at Courtauld Gallery, the same two places you mentioned, after being frustrated by the crowds at Westminster Abbey and the National Gallery. And, you know, when I was at Suffolk Cathedral, there was a feeling of community there and everything was beautifully described and I felt welcome everywhere. There were people wearing their volunteer vests that were posted, happy to answer my questions. And it just felt like a delightful human experience as opposed to a big long line and trampling in and trampling out in the other more famous sites.
I remember that exactly. I felt so welcome from the moment I got to their courtyard and I saw their sweet little cafe that had some outdoor seating that was there to raise money for their mission. To the person that waited on me inside, there were volunteers, just like you said. Everybody was open for questions. I could take my time. I could look at things. I learned some things about William Shakespeare that I didn't know. And even on the way out, when I stopped in the gift shop, I had the great pleasure of meeting their cat. Hodge was his name. Beautiful tuxedo cat, and that just charmed the socks off of
me. You wouldn't meet you wouldn't meet the manager's cat at Westminster Abbey, I'm afraid. You'd meet a policeman saying you can't go there.
But exactly.
But in Southwark Cathedral, Southwick, but pronounced Southwick. What's also poignant about that is it's on the south bank of the Thames, right by the Globe Theatre. And it was bombed, heavily bombed, in World War II. So you've got this sort of rebuild along with the old medieval together. And there's all that sort of that emotion of a war and then of a recovery and of people taking care of people. And I just thought it was a beautiful experience and a delightful opportunity to connect with a neighborhood. And then you mentioned the Courtauld Gallery. And this is a small gallery. Of course, the National Gallery is the big National Gallery. You've got hundreds and hundreds of, I was going to say paintings. You've got hundreds of rooms, I would imagine, filled with paintings. But at the Courtauld Gallery, you're probably going to look at 40 or 50 works of art, and there's going to be absolutely no crowds there. It's just a quality experience. You don't need to see 200 pieces of art to have a wonderful experience. If you have a well-curated, well-described, well-lit, uncrowded gallery, you're talking the Courtauld Gallery in London.
It was an absolute delight to go there. My cousin recommended it. I'm so glad I went. It was intimate. The staff was friendly. They had a little cafe I actually took a break at, not that I needed one because it is an intimate space, but it was just nice to sit and have a cup of tea. It was a relaxing experience versus a stressful one. So I hope that everybody who travels to big cities, especially during crowded holiday periods, thinks about other options and other things they can enjoy while they're there.
And Mary, you could write a book about how to get intimate with London, I think, because you also mentioned that instead of going to the major department stores, you had a good alternative.
I did. I love the major department stores. I've been to London several times, but I've seen them. It was crowded, and honestly, I wasn't going to buy anything from those upscale stores. But I know that along Piccadilly and Bond Street areas, there are a few beautiful Victorian arcades that you can walk through. Gosh, just the architecture is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
One is like 200 yards long. They're just beautiful, full of little boutique-type shops. So they are often upscale, but they are just absolutely stunning. Another thing I absolutely love to do is go to charity shops. England does charity shops, right? Many different charities have stores all over London. I went to Oxfam's. I went to the British Heart Association. What's fun about those shops is you don't know what you're going to find in there. They have resale things, but they also have new things, like locally made greeting cards and note cards.
Yeah.
It's cool.
And I've found that added bonus is you get volunteers who are very talkative. They're doing what they love to do. They're volunteering for a certain charity, and you stumble in from the other side of the world, and they're just thrilled to meet you, and they've got all sorts of stories to share.
Exactly.
All right. Mary, thanks for your call, and best wishes in your travels.
Thank you.
Bye now. Our Travel with Rick Steves listeners are revealing how they cope with crowds they're finding at Europe's increasingly popular destinations. We're at 877-333-RICK, and radio@ricksteves.com is our email address. And Michael's calling in from our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Hi, Michael.
Hi. How do you do?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? Are you thinking about traveling?
As a matter of fact, yes. And actually, crowd situations in Barcelona, which have changed since I first visited as a very junior naval officer a long time ago. Mind you, it's great to go to places like the Church de la Familia and some of the other Gaudi buildings, but I found decades ago, and I continue to find it just as good today, that if you go where the locals go, you're going to have a great time. Specifically in Barcelona, you can just ask around what bus will take me to Tibidabo. And Tibidabo is an awesome amusement park where the only crowds will be locals, and it won't be the kind of mob scene you see on the Robles. Tibidabo sits on the mountainside within the Barcelona city limits, accessed by public bus, and you look down over the whole city and the Mediterranean beyond you. So can't say enough good things about going where local people go.
So Tibidabo, the mountainside amusement park, and, you know, especially in Barcelona, if you can do things that are not on the bucket list of all the cruise travelers, you're going to do yourself a huge favor. I mean, anything with Gaudi's name on it is going to be mobbed and quite expensive. I mean, they're great to see. But, boy, get a reservation in advance if you want to see the Church of the Sagrada Familia. You know, everybody goes to the Ramblas, but it's not the same Ramblas that made it so famous and beloved, because the local people have been driven out by the high rent that comes with landlords being able to get involved with the Airbnb work. So, consequently, the local markets are just catering to tourists instead of locals, and it's just not your grandmother's Ramblas.
Venice, another crowd situation.
Yeah.
If anybody likes soccer, the few remaining locals who live and work in Venice go to see their local football soccer club.
Hmm.
And I discovered that on my last visit. And you get to the stadium, it's in Venice, sitting on the canals and all, and you get there by a regular regular boat.
So one of the buses, like the Vaporettos, they're floating buses,
yeah,
basically.
They've
got numbers,
right.
and that's a Vaporetto stop, the stadium. Huh? I've in all the years I've been going to Venice, it never occurred to me there must be a soccer stadium, and the Vaporetto goes there. Ha!
That's correct, and you want to meet locals,
yeah,
that's the place to do it.
Well, you won't meet tourists there. They're all in the main square paying $25 for a glass of wine.
You bet.
Good advice. Thanks, Michael.
You bet.
Take care. I'll see you on Tibidabo.
Righto.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about beating the crowds, and Meg in Perth, Australia has emailed us, and Meg writes, "In Italy, I like to stay in the quaint seaside village of Camogli, with its painted houses. It's 1 hour by train from the Cinque Terre. I prefer to explore the trails around the Parco Portofino area. I hike around the bay to Punta Chiappa. Then I take the ferry to the Abbey of San Fruttuoso, and then another ferry to Portofino, and walk along the flat road past stunning beaches to Santa Margherita. From here, it's only 10 minutes by train back to Camogli. It's a stunning area with many Italian tourists and not many international tourists." Meg, that is a great day, it sounds like. I have not done most of that, but to take walks, to take ferry rides, to follow stunning roads along stunning beaches, connecting places that are not on everybody's hit list, it makes a huge difference. Pat's given us a call from Genoa City in Wisconsin. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Rick, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for calling. What's your experience with crowds in your travels?
Well, I don't avoid them. I try to find them. We were in Berlin this last September, and we happened to be by the Brandenburg Gate on a Saturday morning, and that's when different groups gather there for demonstrations.
Hmm.
And because it's Germany, they're all very well organized with these demonstrations.
Yeah.
And so the first group was a group demonstrating about dental benefits for the National Health Care Plan. And I still don't know whether they were for or against it. But. And then the next group was rather large gay men dressed in leather harnesses.
Wow. So you're going for the interesting crowds.
Exactly.
Right.
So part of travel is trying to but become part of the local folks, and this is a way to do that.
I guess the difference is when we say crowds, you can be referring to crowds of locals doing their cultural thing, or you can have crowds of tourists gawking to look at some cliché. And what you're doing is you're connecting with the local energy when you go to a crowd. Did you mention that on Saturdays they have that's kind of the thing, they almost book their time to have a demonstration around Brandenburg Gate?
It seemed to be, The one group is there from 10 to 11. They're demonstrating for or against dental benefits. And then at 11, another group comes in.
I've got two memories that just talking to you have been rekindled in my mind. I was standing in front of Brandenburg Gate trying to do it on camera for the TV show. Cameras rolling, and there's all these people demonstrating all around us. And I'm thinking, we can't shoot this. But my cameraman said, it's okay, nobody's in the frame, go for it. But it was just inundated with demonstrators. And then on an earlier trip, I was on the main Unter den Linden Street there, right by Brandenburg Gate, and it was a gay pride parade. And you saw a group of large gay men dressed in leather harnesses. This was a parade filled with characters like that, and it just seemed they were doing their best to shock the audience, and nobody was shocked. It was just a festival of life and diversity, and it was just a hoot, and I was really glad I was on the curb enjoying that scene.
That's the way we felt, too.
So there you go. So Pat is talking about avoiding the tourist crowds, perhaps, but making a point to experience the action when it's happening with the locals. And I think that's very good advice.
Yes.
All right. Hey, Pat, thanks so much for your reminder that there are good crowds that we should not avoid, and that it's quite rewarding to get out of your comfort zone and celebrate the cultures of the lands you're visiting.
Yes, it's part of travel.
Hey, you betcha. Okay. Thanks a lot. Happy travels.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Talk to you later.
We're hearing strategies from our Travel with Rick Steves listeners for dealing with the crowds that we're finding at many of the top visitor sites in Europe. We'll check in with more of you later this summer to hear about how it's been going for you. In the meantime, you can send us a quick report on your own travel adventures by emailing us at radio@ricksteves.com. Ryan's given us a call from Altadena in California. Hey, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Rick.
So, Ryan, we're talking about avoiding crowds, and you're thinking about Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously such natural beauty and charm there. You know, people think of the Dingle Peninsula and Galway and the Cliffs of Moher, and for good reason. And they're all in the south, in the Republic. And there's also the north, and that, to me, is the travel back door into Ireland. If you take a car and head out of Belfast along the Antrim coast, past the glens of Antrim, to the Giant's Causeway, and there's an amazing thing called the Carricarete Rope Bridge and Dunluce Castle. You'll find scenery and some charm that rivals, in my opinion, just about anything you can find in the south, with far less crowds. I mean, you know, there'll be some people in the parking lot, and you'll pass a couple people on the path down to, say, the Giant's Causeway, which is amazing, and there's really nothing like it in the south at all. But I just think it's such an opportunity to experience what people think of when they think of Ireland, but without, you know, 20 tour buses in a row.
Without the mob scenes.
And that kind of stuff.
You know, Ryan, have you noticed, it seems like the factor of everybody going to a few places is just getting more so. It's like there's more people than ever traveling, and the targeted destinations are fewer than ever before. And it really causes an imbalance where some places are just a zoo, and other places you go, hey, where is everybody?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, a perfect example of that, and not that I want people to crowd into it, but next to the places I've been talking about, you have a lovely city called Derry, which I think is completely underappreciated, and you have Donegal, which is still technically part of the south.
Yeah.
But to me, that is wild Ireland as it used to be and is an amazing place to visit. And there's nobody there.
That's the part of Northern Ireland that's not part of Northern Ireland, but is still part of the Republic. Yeah, the northwest of Ireland, Donegal. And I was very, very impressed by how I just felt off the grid, even if I was still on the grid. I just felt, wow, I'm really, really away from the crowds. You mentioned the Carricarete Rope Bridge.
Right.
That's a good example. I mean, it's a famous place, but it's in a less touristed corner of Ireland. And you park your car and you walk down there and you get over to that sea stack or whatever it connects the mainland with, this hanging bridge. And it's a bird sanctuary. And you can actually feel close to nature there. And you got birds all around you rather than tour buses and, you know, shops and all the noise that comes with mass tourism. And you just feel like you did the right thing to take it a little step further than the tourist trap on the south coast of Ireland.
Yeah, and they're not hard to get to either.
Very easy, and the people love to talk, which I love. You can get the most remote corner of Ireland and go to a pub, and you've got a most fascinating conversation, just because whether you know it or not, if you're an American traveling in Ireland, you are one interesting character, and people would love to spill their guts for you.
That is exactly true.
That's so great.
Like I started with, I mean, a lot of the things that you think of are the heart and soul of Ireland, you find in the north just like you find in the south. I mean, it's all the same island, and it's all the same lovely people. And there's just some amazing natural beauty up there like there is down in the south.
And, of course, in Ireland, you know, the first night in a pub, you're a guest. And then the second night at the pub, you're a regular, just like everybody else. And they say, what do they say? They say, strangers are just friends who've yet to meet.
Oh, that's so true.
I love it. All right, Ryan, thanks so much for your call.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
Happy travels.
Thank you, Buck.
As she onward sped, sure I scratched me head, and I looked with a feeling rare. And I says I to a passerby, who's the maid with the nut brown hair. He smiled at me and he says to me, that's the gem in Ireland's crown. Young Rosie McCann from the banks of the Ban, she's the star of the County Down. From Ballintreebay up to Derrycay and from Galway to Dublin town. No maid I've seen like the brown colleen that I met in the County Down.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kasmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests, listen to a podcast version of the show, and search the archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
I've found that if you equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart, you can. And that's why the Rick Steves guidebooks are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. Pick up the latest edition at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com.